As if those grumpy White House reporters weren't enough, Obama wants you.
We're going to take advantage of the internet to bring all of you to the White House to talk about the economy. Here's the idea. Right now at whitehouse.gov, anyone can submit a question.
I'd love to ask President Barack Obama how I or just ordinary people could help him achieve the change he's looking for.
Bypassing the mainstream media, Obama creates his own virtual town meeting. The president calls and raises a primetime news conference with a new idea. How many people will the Secret Service allow into whitehouse.gov? Meet the Prez. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 25th. Coming up this hour, we'll take a closer look at the president's real news conference last night. We'll also take a look at China's call for the creation of a new international currency to replace, that's right, the greenback. And we'll discuss what it means to be a social investor. Those stories coming up, but first headlines. Businessmen do business. President Obama says that's the key to helping the economy recover. He says people can't let their anger about executive bonuses get in the way of that.
The rest of us can't afford to demonize every investor or entrepreneur who seeks to make a profit. That drive is what has always fueled our prosperity, and it is what will ultimately get these banks lending and our economy moving once more.
Relying on business women might help as well. That said, the president also emphasized the need for the government to have the ability to regulate non-bank entities such as AIG. He's expected to lobby for that new regulation on Capitol Hill today, as well as his 2010 budget. The president said he's prepared to negotiate.
If this were easy, then we would have already had it done, and the budget would have been voted on, and everybody could go home.
And we could go home. Committees in both House and the Senate begin work on the budget today. Mark Garrison, don't go home. What else is out there?
I'm here. And good morning, John. Before heading over to Congress, President Obama will meet with the Secretary General of NATO. The meeting comes as Obama prepares for his first trip to Europe and prepares his strategy in Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will stay closer to home, traveling to Mexico today for a two-day trip. She'll discuss the joint strategy to combat drug-related violence there. The visit comes a day after the Obama administration announced sending more money and federal agents to help Mexico. President Obama's pick to be the next ambassador to Iraq has his Senate hearings today. Christopher Hill, you probably remember him when you've heard stories about North Korea. He was the State Department's lead legislator, or lead negotiator, rather. Overseas, Israel's incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will seek a peace agreement with the Palestinians. He's got a new government. And Asian stocks were mixed today. Hong Kong's main index dropped by 2%. Japan's also down just a little bit.
And profit-taking or something, the Wall Street futures are trading flat to positive. Wall Street was unable to keep its momentum up yesterday, though. The Dow fell 1.5% yesterday to close at 7660. The S&P fell 2% to 806. So later on this hour, we're going to be talking to an American woman who came across a child wearing her hand-me-down blue sweater from when she was a girl. The child was in Rwanda, half a world away. That experience made her realize how interconnected we all are on the planet. So this morning, we want you to tell us about a coincidence in your life that was life-changing in the same way. A moment when you realized how interconnected you were with the rest of the world. Coincidences that change your view of the blue planet. A blue sweater did for one person. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. What is the network's, what did they say last night? We interrupt our regularly scheduled programs for a special White House news conference. And last night, Barack Obama entered the West Wing, faced the White House press corps. And boy, the initial impression was 9 weeks into his administration, the campaign seems like a long, long time ago.
I think that the last 64 days has been dominated by me trying to figure out how we're going to fix the economy. And that affects black, brown, and white. Obviously, at the inauguration, I think that there was justifiable pride on the part of the country that we had taken a step to move us beyond some of the searing legacies of racial discrimination in this country. That lasted about a day.
Barack Obama there at his news conference last night, almost impatiently dismissing, oh, race, oh, that, I remember that. April Ryan joins us. She's White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks in Washington. And Dan Frumkin writes the White House Watch blog for The Washington Post. Both of you join us from the nation's capital this morning. April and Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So there was news, there was atmospherics, and there was a sense of tone and a shift, it seems to me, in the role of the actual White House press corps in this event last night. It was really fascinating to watch. April, what do you think the big headline is out of last night?
Well, sitting in the room, one thing for sure is that the president has a new teleprompter. That's one of the big news events of the day that we heard, that we saw last evening at the very beginning. You know, the president is no longer using that teleprompter that everyone's talking about going side to side. He looks straight ahead. He did the same thing that he's been doing and talking about on the issue of the economy. But, you know, there was a little pushback, as you mentioned, with Ed Henry from CNN talking about AIG. The president basically said, look, I need time to review things before I speak. I need to listen and watch and get all of my information before I speak. And it was 13 questions like he did in the first press conference, but it really wasn't any news in it. And he came out, he wanted to update America, but for the press, we weren't really, I guess, impressed too much because we've been hearing about the budget, and I think the American people have been hearing some of the same, too.
Well, April, let me address this to Dan then for a moment. I mean, it seems to me going in, we here at The Takeaway, sort of editorially trying to figure out what the headlines were going to be at this event, really thought, okay, he really needs to lead with this idea of education, the environment, and healthcare, because that's the pushback he's getting from Congress. Is that consistent with the statements that Barack Obama made and the continually returning to those themes, even in questions that were unrelated to health care and the environment, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he hammered on those time and time and time again, and I think that was a really key part of what I think his main strategy was for last night, and a very successful one, which was to really use his bully pulpit to sort of move beyond a lot of the chatter of the last week, you know, which was about the AIG bonuses and sort of this emerging media narrative that he's sort of on the ropes and overreached and overexposed and what have you, and instead get back to the basics that he thinks lay the foundation for, as he would put it, you know, a secure and lasting prosperity.
I think he
showed a lot of the qualities that the public really does seem to like, you know, and at the end he talked about how he's persistent, and I think that's key among them, and part of that persistence was hammering about how, you know, his focus on health and education and energy are not, you know, just luxury is not something he just sort of frills he came up with, but he considers absolutely essential to the recovery.
And he really seemed to say that the process is just beginning and that you can't, you know, sort of nail him down on whether he would or would not sign a budget with any particular provision. Here's an exchange that I think is typical of how the president returned to the themes that he wants the American people to pick up and help convince Congress to go with.
No, what I said was I haven't seen yet what provisions are in there. The bottom line is that I want to see health care, energy, education, and serious efforts to reduce our budget deficit. And there are going to be a lot of details that are still being worked out, but I have confidence that we're going to be able to get a budget done that's reflective of what needs to happen in order to make sure that America grows.
Do you think that confidence, April Ryan, is misplaced in the sense that he's counting on the kind of reception from the American people broadly that he got in California at these more scripted events?
Well, he wants to come out and talk to the American people, that's for sure. And he is consistent. I mean, he has saturated the airwaves over the last few days on the issues of the economy to include energy, education, and deficit reduction. But, you know, that question from Jake Tapper from ABC was what you just basically played, the response from
right.
The president. And it was about the middle class tax cut. And the president was talking about you know, what would be in his budget and what he would accept. And he let people know that, you know, for the next 2 years, at the very least, the middle class tax cut will be in place. But at issue, the president is definitely, again, as you said, and as he said last night, basically persistence pays, and he's going to keep hammering this home. And he's got to hammer it home because he is not getting the reception now from Hill lawmakers, to include some in his own party, to push this budget through. So he's got to keep moving and use the bully pulpit. But it's a proposal, a push that continues to keep going, and we're not hearing anything new. There was no new news out of this press conference last night.
You know, it's interesting to me, though, I think, is that what you saw last night was that Obama is operating on a very different clock than the press corps. I think that the press corps, which is representing sort of the D.C. political media elite view, is very keen on day-to-day ups and downs. So, you know, as April said, there was no news, so everybody went away disappointed. What I think he's looking at a much longer view, and I think the public is giving him that time right now. And so I think you saw somebody sort of aiming over the heads of the press corps, aiming over the heads of Congress. The challenge he faces is that at some point Congress does need to approve his budget, and you know, he's basically put forth a budget that is very much a challenge to the Washington establishment, very much sort of a threat to the conventional wisdom. And Congress, to a large degree, represents the Washington establishment. And how he's going to get Congress to go along is a good question.
Well, you know, the one thing tactically that I thought was worthy of note at this news conference, even though it wasn't newsworthy, April, I think you're absolutely right, is, you know, the tax cut is built into the stimulus package, so Congress actually doesn't get to do much with the tax cut for the next 2 years, so he's won that one already. The question of health care and the environment, he's put it in the hands of Congress that if they come to him with a budget that has nothing of those in it, they're in trouble. It's really on them. So basically, the pressure is on Congress. What was interesting to me, though, was how if Obama is aiming over the heads of the Washington Press Corps, people like Ed Henry were aiming directly at the head of Barack Obama. You referred already to this moment. Let's play it, and then I want to ask you guys a question here.
Why did you wait days to come out and express that outrage? It seems like the action is coming out of New York and the Attorney General's office. It took you days to come public with Secretary Geithner and say, look, we're outraged. Why did it take so long?
It took us a couple of days because I like to know what I'm talking about before I speak.
Now, April, that was at the end of a long exchange where Ed Henry of CNN was trying to get Obama to admit he was late or something and placing him up against Andrew Cuomo here in New York. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me, looking at that the press corps for the 8 years of the Bush administration it had done a lot of softballing, and they're not so good at hardballing anymore. That seemed fairly ham-handed to me. What did you think?
Well, let me say this. I talked to Ed Henry after the press conference, and we even talked before the press conference. You know, a lot of the reporters got together and said, what do you think is going to be asked? You know, and everyone had a lot of questions. And I can tell you for a fact, Ed said, look, he said, no one was hitting on AIG. And when he finally came to me, he said, I was like the sixth one in. I had to hit him with it. And he had other questions. So, and that was something that was definitely on the plate, because before the president went to California, you know, people were asking the questions, why are you coming out now? You know, when was the timeline? I even asked in one of the press briefings, you know, the then Bush administration was saying that they were informing the transition team in the Obama camp for the president-elect at that time about this information. And there was a big question, and no one had asked it. So Ed said, you know, it was time for me to ask, and it was appropriate for him to ask. And unfortunately, you know, what you guys may think are softballs, they may be, but then again, I mean, how would you pose a question to the president of the United States so he doesn't shut you down?
A hint, April, you use Andrew Cuomo to get the ire up, and I think Ed Henry was very astute in doing that. April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks, and Dan Frumkin writes the White House Watch blog for the Washington Post, taking a look at reaction to the Obama administration news conference last night in primetime. Obama met the press corps. Thanks to you both.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A little later this hour, we're going to be talking to an American woman who came across a child in Rwanda wearing her hand-me-down blue sweater, a garment that she grew up with and fell in love with and was suddenly staring at in the middle of Rwanda. That experience transformed her view of how interconnected we all are in the world. So this morning, we want you to tell us about a coincidence in your life that was life-changing in some way, changed your worldview, or just a coincidence that's fascinating to talk about, a moment when you realized how connected you were with the rest of the world. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org, your blue sweater stories. All right, so, you know, far be it from me to dispute the formidable April Ryan in our segment about the Barack Obama news conference, but there was news at the news conference last night. You had to listen closely to it. The president was asked at a certain point, is there a need for a global currency? And he had a very quick response.
Excuse me. I don't believe that there's a need for a global currency.
The president was responding to the head of China's central bank calling for the eventual creation of a new international currency reserve to replace the dollar. China has the world's largest foreign exchange reserves valued at nearly $2 trillion, with more than half of those holdings estimated to be made up of dollar-denominated bonds, including U.S. Treasury bonds. And earlier this month, the Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao said he was concerned about the safety of those assets. So is this a tactic on the part of the Chinese to pull away from the dollar? Jeff Madrick, director of the Policy Research Institute at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School right here in New York, joins us. When China, which has sort of sensitively been looking for a way around its dollar problem, suggests that maybe a global currency is the answer. I mean, on any other day, this would be the biggest headline in the world. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big headline. I think the president, while if I were president, I would have said, no, we don't need a global currency. As an observer and an economic analyst, I say we probably over time do need a global currency. I think China stepping forward represents probably the biggest public symbol yet of the lost hegemony of America because of the way we managed the economy over the last 10 to 20 years.
Well, it's a linguistic transformation in the sense that maybe 5 years ago, people would be saying, you know, the dollar actually is the global currency. But now thinking about a replacement is a suggestion that the stability of the U.S. dollar is not what it might seem. Respond to this, because Barack Obama did have some things to say about the dollar last night when he was asked on this subject.
I would just point out that the dollar is extraordinarily strong right now. And the reason the dollar is strong right now is because investors consider the United States the strongest economy in the world and with the most stable political system in the world. So you don't have to take my word for it. I think that there is a great deal of confidence that ultimately, although we are going through a rough patch, that the prospects for the world economy are very, very strong.
Barack Obama talking about the dollar last night. The good news is everyone has confidence in the dollar. The bad news is when they don't, then poof, it's over. Would you say
that's precisely true? Right now, the president is right. Right now, he said, I believe, what he had to say. The dollar has been the linchpin of the world economy really since World War II. Mm-hmm. One interesting bit of history is John Maynard Keynes, who was involved with that first Bretton Woods system, didn't want the dollar to be the linchpin. He did want a basket of securities because he recognized it's too much burden for one currency, but it became the expedient way to do things. For that, however, the world does pay a price.
But there is a long economic arc here from the gold standard in the period of World War I leading up to the Depression to the basket of currencies. It was the Bretton Woods decision that you describe. What would a global currency look like in this postmodern era envisioned by the Chinese and I suspect economists like yourself?
Well, it would look like a basket of currencies. We've got something like that now, special drawing rights that only only the IMF uses. So it would be a currency based on a basket, so we didn't depend on the health of any one particular economy. I think.
So wait, so just to figure that out for idiots like me,
yeah.
that would mean that the global currency wouldn't necessarily be in circulation to consumers, but for institutional transactions and government-to-government transactions, there would be a global currency.
Right. We would not be replacing the dollar with something like an SDR or a banco or some new kind of currency. No, it would be for trade and capital flows internationally.
Is this suggestion by the Chinese a very big issue for the G20 all of a sudden in April convening in the UK?
You know, John, a lot of people have been talking about changing over from the current system where the dollar has been very high. Now, a high dollar has helped America to some degree. It makes it a lot cheaper to borrow. But it also puts our export industries at a serious disadvantage. It makes our manufacturing exports expensive. That's hurt. The dollar has risen by 100% since the late 1980s. Imagine if you were a manufacturer having to deal with that kind of cost stress. So a lower dollar over time would help. A more managed currency system, I think, would help. A lot of people have been talking about that for a long time, and I think in the long run, it would be beneficial.
Is there a dollar bubble, and are we at the top of it? And if it collapses, we'll be looking at inflation in double digits in 5 years?
That's a great question. Everybody used to joke, the Onion used to joke, and everybody talked about America looking for the next bubble. We could have a bubble, the Treasury bill bubble, which is a dollar bubble. And economists can't quite figure it. It's hard to get your head around what will happen after we get past this crisis. Could there be a sudden collapse in the dollar, meaning a sudden rise in interest rates? And then the Chinese idea, which at the moment looks long run and difficult to engineer. But if there's a collapse in the dollar, that might hasten interest in this kind of issue.
Well, it's fascinating and a little harrowing to contemplate. But Jeff Madrick, thanks for helping us sort things out. Jeff's the Director of Policy Research at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School right here in New York. Thanks, Jeff. And Mark Garrison has more headlines now.
Thank you, John. I always appreciate when economists cite The Onion as something to look at.
Are you discrediting Jeff?
No. I'm just glad that he's looking at other sources and culturally looking at how people view the economy. But in any case, 28 minutes after the hour, Congress is working on the 2010 budget today. The president is on the Hill to lobby in favor of the $3.6 trillion request. He says the U.S. needs to invest now to prevent another economic collapse in the future.
The budget I submitted to Congress will build our economic recovery on a stronger foundation so that we don't face another crisis like this 10 or 20 years from now.
Lawmakers are talking cuts in response to new rising deficit projections. They want to get rid of a possible tax credit for the middle class and maybe look at cutting money to help give further money to helping banks. A new report by the National Urban League says black Americans are twice as likely to be unemployed and three times as likely to be in poverty. The annual State of Black America report calls on the president to increase government services. Among the recommendations, more job training, education, health care, and mortgage counseling. The Postal Service is going to Congress for help today. Postmaster General John Potter will appear before a House committee, subcommittee rather. The post office was $2.8 billion in the red last year. In the past, he said the post office might reduce mail delivery to 5 days a week. John.
Thank you, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
In the gilded White House room last night, you may have seen the president confronting the mainstream media, the White House press corps. He had a news conference last night, but he also opened an alternative news conference on the website, whitehouse.gov, asking, if you had one question for President Obama, what would it be?
If I had something to ask President Obama right now, it'd be, what is he truly afraid of right now? What is his concern for his presidency and his success. I guess, you know, we don't get to hear much about that part of the man. You know, he seems very much put together all of the time, so I want to know what he's afraid of.
What is Barack Obama afraid of? What is your question? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The president is soliciting questions from regular Americans, non-accredited journalists, and what would yours be?
I would ask the president what he's told his own daughters about the financial crisis and how, as a parent, he has tried to reassure them or explain to them what's going on in our country. Financial distress has a lot of destructive effects on families, and I'm very curious how the president, as a person, is addressing that issue with his own family.
If you weren't invited to the primetime news conference last night but still had a question for the president, tell us what you would have asked. You can submit it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. They're also taking questions over there at whitehouse.gov, a little place in Washington, D.C. at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. All right, so it's a shock in the cricket world, particularly in India. India has decided that security is too difficult for it to hold the premier cricket league competition inside India. Indian cricket fans, and there are millions of them, are outraged.
It is bad for our economy and a lot, and most of the time it is bad for all fans of cricket, and it is so shocking for the cricket fan.
If that match is happening outside India, like, the feeling is not going to be there. The support is not going to be there. So it'll be lackluster.
Joining us now is BBC Managing Editor Rob Hugh-Jones from BBC Bush House in London. Rob, this is a huge takeaway managing editor. This is a huge story in Britain, and it is a huge story for cricketers around the world because it's really a measure of the security situation in South Asia.
Yes, that's right. It's really a measure of the of just how insecure the place is. You know, if you remember, we had the attacks in Mumbai. In very fresh in our memories, we had attacks in Pakistan that was actually against the Sri Lankan cricket team. Seven of the team were injured in that, including officials. You know, there's a wave or a fresh memory of insecurity in the region, and this has impacted on this particular story. But it is a remarkable thing. If you imagine after 9/11, if the U.S. government, the federal authorities, had decided to take the World Series or the Super Bowl out of America because they were concerned about security in this country and the worries and possibilities of another attack. That's kind of what you've just seen in India. I mean, if you look at it time-wise, India is facing a general election next month. It would be a month-long election, and that roughly coincided with the period that these 59 games were going to be played as part of the Indian Premier League over the course of the month. And the Indian authorities said, look, we can't, we have so much security to worry about over the elections, we can't also extend ourselves to cover security for these games, which is an astonishing admission.
Well, it's a politically significant admission, as you mentioned. It's right in the middle of the election campaign. What sort of hit does the government take as a loss in global prestige and certainly domestic prestige in not being able to pull this off?
Well, I think a lot. I mean, as a sort of, if you're a cricket fan around the world, you can understand why Pakistan might not be able to host this competition because it's, you know, it's got such a recent history of instability. But India, did you really expect them to say no to this? I mean, I think if you look at it from a, you know, international diplomacy political point of view, it makes the Indian government look very weak. It makes the Indian government look unable to secure its own territory, something that, you know, we've heard echoes of that from the Mexican leader, for goodness sake, about being unable to secure his own territory, which was something significant recently. Now that India is saying the same thing.
I'm wondering if we should set this in context, though. I mean, you know, aside from the utter inscrutability of the rules of cricket to most Americans, the level of popularity of the game in India is really a couple of orders of magnitude, it would seem to me, beyond what we associate with, say, the Super Bowl or baseball. I mean, is that one of the security problems here, that the almost obsessive popularity of cricket really plays into the security difficulties that are beyond what we would encounter here in the United States?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the cricket is absolutely it's an old cliche, but it's worshipped in South Asia. Absolutely worshipped. You hear people routinely talking about cricket as being iconic or godlike, and it really does mean an enormous amount to people's lives. It's interwoven into their lives, and it has an enormous kind of cultural depth. So if a cricket competition of this magnitude and this profile was attacked, for example, or unsettled or upset in some way, that would be a major victory for anyone trying to embarrass the government. So it is a massive thing. If you go to a cricket match, as I have in India before, it is astonishing. There are well over 100,000 people, sometimes 200,000 people, packed into ramshackle stadiums, making a vast amount of noise. You can't talk to the person next to you. There's that amount of noise going on. There's a tremendous passion, and the Indian cricket players, let alone the players from other countries, are absolute heroes in their own land. They walk around with bodyguards. They can't go. You know, people like Sachin Tendulkar is probably the most famous name. He can't go to public places. He would be absolutely besieged by fans.
Well, the loss for India is certainly South Africa's gain. Rob Hugh-Jones, Takeaway Managing Editor, joining us to talk about how India, for security reasons, has decided to relocate the Indian Premier cricket competition to South Africa, something that's going to cast doubt on suspicions that India might have been preparing a bid for the Olympics over the next decade. And now with headlines, Mark Garrison is here.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, and new economic numbers are just out a few moments ago, and there's a little surprise in them. Durable goods orders posted a surprising jump last month. Economists had predicted a drop. That's been the trend for months. Durable basically meaning stuff you buy and keep, so not food or commodities, but rather appliances, cars, computers, that kind of thing. And that's number to watch because it tells us about what consumers are buying, so we'll see how the markets react to that. Next hour, also later this morning, housing numbers will come out on sales of new homes. President Obama's pick for ambassador to Iraq goes before the Senate today. Christopher Hill headed nuclear disarmament talks with North Korea under the Bush administration. Republicans have questioned his lack of Mideast experience. Former top Mideast commander, retired General Anthony Zinni, said he was initially offered the post, but the administration pulled the offer and gave it to Hill. Investigators in Pennsylvania are trying to determine if the man charged with arson in a Philadelphia suburb could be responsible for other fires. Firefighter Robert Tracy is charged with lighting two small blazes on Friday. Now, Coatesville, Pennsylvania, and the surrounding area, there have been dozens of unsolved fires there this year, so they're looking as to whether he's connected with those.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us now from Moscow is Rupert Wingfield Hayes from the BBC. And in this economic downturn, we possibly are seeing the demise of globally famous automobile brands. So General Motors, Chevrolet, the Saturn, the Hummer, of course, is probably gone already. But in Russia, the Lada, one of the most famous cars in the world, and maybe not in a good way, is possibly on its way out as well. And its hometown in a city in central Russia called Tolyatti is very much concerned about what could happen to the much maligned Lada. Here to talk about it, Rupert Wingfield Hayes. What is the threat to Lada? And remind us of the Lada's reputation, won't you?
Well, I'd say, John, even here in Russia, Ladas are not exactly much loved. There's certainly no fashion statement, but they have a place in Russian history because, of course, Ladas, which began being built in the 1960s, they imported an old Fiat factory to Russia, and they started making these cars down in Tolyatti, and they were the first sort of people's car for the Soviet Union, and they produced millions and millions of them, and they put Soviet people or Russian people on four wheels for the first time. So they do have a place in Russian people's hearts, and they do have a place in Russian culture. They are still pretty awful cars, it has to be said.
Right. I mean, one of the places in Russian culture for those cars is on the side of the road, jacked up with the tires off, correct?
That's true. I mean, I always ask my Russian friends, why on earth do people continue buying larders? And their usual answer is, well, you know, the good thing about a larder is you can always just fix it beside the road. And I always respond, well, if you bought another car, you perhaps wouldn't have to fix your car beside the road all the time. But that is the way they see it. It's a very simple, very basic car that can be fixed anywhere and will keep on going for years and years and years, even if it's not very comfortable, not very good. But there has been a huge decline in the number of people buying these, even in Russia. I mean, if you look back 10 years, in 2000, 7 or 8 out of 10 cars bought in Russia was a Lada. Today, it's 2 out of 10, and it's really declining rapidly. And now, with the onset of this latest economic crisis, Lada is really in big, big trouble. It doesn't have any money, it's not selling any cars, and it can't pay its parts suppliers. Literally, it can't pay its parts suppliers.
It can't even pay its hockey team.
That's right. That's right. I was down in Toliati last week and went to see the hockey team playing. And Lada hockey team is a very good hockey team. It's one of the best ice hockey teams in Russia. It's won the Russian league several times. Some of its players have gone on to play in the NHL. And a lot of people joke that the only good thing about Lada is its hockey team. But their players have not been paid for the last 3 months.
Now, does that mean possibly that while we are crying over here in the United States over the potential demise of possibly Chrysler, maybe even some brands at General Motors, that the people in Russia, as they proliferate foreign currency reserves to a certain extent, are actually viewing the demise of the Lada as a sign of economic progress?
No, I don't think so. But they have had 20 years to get Lada sorted out, and it really hasn't been sorted out. And I think, you know, that's why it's in the parlous state that it is now. It's like the same problems as General Motors and Ford and Chrysler and other car makers around the world, except much, much worse, because they really haven't turned themselves into a modern car company and started making cars that people really want to buy.
Lada, Lada, Lada. That's sort of the demise of the most famous and much maligned car brand in Russia. Rupert Wingfield Hayes, thanks for joining us from Moscow.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, how one woman's discovery unexpectedly of a familiar blue sweater changed her view of our blue planet. Then in a moment, right after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama is emphasizing the need for new financial rules. In his press conference last night, the president backed up Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner's call for the power to take over failing firms like AIG.
We should have obtained it much earlier so that any institution that poses a systemic risk that could bring down the financial system, we can handle. And we can do it in an orderly fashion that quarantines it from other institutions. We don't have that power right now. That's what Secretary Geithner was talking about.
At the moment, the government can take over banks. That's basically what the FDIC does. But hedge funds, investment firms, insurance companies, the government doesn't have the power to take them over. That's what the administration is calling for. Overseas, a judge in Northern Ireland is ordering police to charge or immediately free six IRA dissidents held for questioning about the killing of British troops there earlier this month. The Police Service of Northern Ireland offered no immediate response. There haven't been charges in those killings. There have, however, been arrests and charges in the killing of a Northern Ireland policeman. Happened around the same time. There's a new arrest today. This follows the first person arrested, which was a teen boy, allegedly a member of a splinter group called the Continuity IRA, which took responsibility for the killing.
Thank you, Mark. So we hear a lot about social entrepreneurship in the world these days. The Gates Foundation, others attempting to create sustainable projects around the world. You hear them in the credits on this program a lot. We're here now with Jacqueline Novogratz, founder of the Acumen Fund. It's also a nonprofit venture. It's a venture capital firm that works in some of the same places that other philanthropists work. But it's an organization that has a very unusual genesis that's described in a new book called The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World. Jacqueline, good morning.
Morning.
We've been asking people all morning about coincidences that cause their sort of head to turn around and to change their way of viewing the world. And the coincidence that you describe in this book is a particularly compelling one. And I wonder if you could sort of you're going to be asked to tell this story for the next like 5 years, and you know that. But bring it to us again.
Okay. I was given a blue sweater by my uncle when I was about 10 years old, and it had zebras in the front and mountains across the chest, and I wore it all the time through high school.
Had a label in it.
Had a label right. in it. And
got that sort of fuzzy kind of warm thing that, you know, a knitted sweater gets over time.
Exactly. Yeah. And over time, my adolescent curves filled it out quite differently. And there was always that humiliating moment in high school where – for an adolescent girl, where
can't wear that anymore.
Can't wear it anymore. Mm-mm. So threw it into the Goodwill, and thought I'd never have to see it again. But fast forward 10 years, and I was jogging through the hills of Kigali, Rwanda. So a decade and 5,000 miles away, and lo and behold, 3 meters in front of me, I see a 10-year-old boy with little spindly legs, and he's wearing my sweater. Run up to the child, grab him by the neck, turn over the collar, and I see my name on the child's sweater. And so I hold it as a metaphor, really, for how interconnected we are as a world.
Now, a lot of people would have an experience like that and go, wow, you know, who would have ever thought that? But for you, it led into a much deeper sense of what it is that are commodified events from the developed world and how they end up in the developing world, which is so used to being commodified as either people or poor people or you know, nations in a state of civil war of one kind or another. You decided to focus directly on that very particular relationship between one object, one woman, and one young boy.
Right. Well, and at the time, I was working in Rwanda on microfinance, and we were making a lot of loans to women with sewing machines in the tailoring industry. And what I learned from this, trying to understand how did that sweater end up there, discovered this whole secondhand clothing market that we put clothes in the Goodwill. It goes to Africa, millions of tons per year, that then are sold by traders in these sprawling markets. And at the time, I thought this was a bad thing because it was displacing tailors.
Right.
But it's one of the best ways for low-income people to actually move into the middle class.
And basically, while many people would see, oh, the sweater is the issue, you saw, no, it's in fact the people behind these objects that are the engine of entrepreneurship in the developing world. How can I tap into that?
Right.
So how did you?
Well, in the 80s, through building a microfinance bank, as it turned out, the women with whom I started the bank played out every conceivable role in the Rwandan genocide. And it was that whole experience in the 90s then that made me reevaluate both markets as well as traditional aid. And so decided that neither markets alone nor traditional aid alone were really alleviating poverty in the way that I thought we could as a world. And so in 2001 built the Acumen Fund, which uses a concept called patient capital between the market and traditional development, and invests in entrepreneurs that are looking at bringing affordable quality services to low-income people.
Now, this idea of patient capital is really, you know, in some sense, a wrapping for two very contradictory phenomena, it seems like. And, you know, what do you make of the Rem Koolhaas, the architect who looks at the shanty cities in a place like Lagos, Nigeria, and goes, oh, look at all of these entrepreneurs, essentially not viewing the extreme poverty there and only seeing this entrepreneurship, which seems to be the market-only fallacy. How do you view that sort of idea?
It is a market-only fallacy. I do see in slums unbelievable potential. But without the opportunity to access affordable goods and services, people are going to stay there. We just had an experience with a woman who ironically works in the secondhand mm-hmm. clothing market. She buys discarded ball gowns and repurposes them for low-income women to buy Holy Communion dresses and Sweet 16 dresses for their daughters. And she's now earning $4, $5, $6 a day.
Where is she?
In the Mathari Valley slum outside of Kenya. So it's a strip of land a mile long, 0.2 miles wide. People are really living in tin boxes. One of the highest rates of prostitution, crime in the world. And so when you look at her, on the one hand, she's moving out of poverty from an income perspective. On the other, she's stuck in this place.
And I mean, that seems to be the great challenge. How do you gauge success when the big picture still looks like a slum, but the small picture is $5 or $6 a day?
Right. Well, you find ways for people to have more control of their lives, because one major health problem can keep people going back to 2-3 because it puts them in debt forever. But if you find ways to create health services that are affordable, they can start moving fully out.
Well, listen to the voice of a woman in an adventure that you actually funded, talking about that sustainability feeling that actually makes people healthier.
They know once they come and pay, then I'm accountable for their health. If they go for free service, whether they get better or not, no one is accountable. I know I have to maintain standards. The clinic has to be absolutely clean. The drugs have to be of the right standards. You have to go out and market yourself, yeah?
Now, that's a woman, Dora Nyanja, who runs a health clinic in outside of Nairobi, talking in an entrepreneurial way about a service that would traditionally have been given for free.
And she's a great example with the chef clinics of a woman not from the Kibera slums, but during the riots last January, the January before last, she came to the slums every single day because she said, these people are my customers, and I need to serve them. And if I don't come, they will be killed and hurt. Whereas so many of the international agencies and aid organizations didn't go into the slums during the riots, Dora slept in her clinic every night. Hmm. And when the boys came to burn down her clinic because she was from the wrong ethnic group, her customers created a human phalanx around that clinic and protected her.
Change is possible.
Change is possible. We see it all the time with Acumen. We've seen tens of millions of people access services they wouldn't otherwise be able to, and 23,000 jobs created over the last 7 years.
And it keeps on going. The Acumen Fund founder, Jacqueline Novogratz, author of the book The Blue Sweater, thanks so much for those stories.
Thank you, John.
And the public fairly begs for a chance to see our legs.
In a sweater,
a sarong,
and a peekaboo pant.
Our thanks to Jacqueline Novogratz, founder and CEO of the Acumen Fund, author of The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World. We want you to tell us about a coincidence in your life that was life-changing when you realized how interconnected you were with the rest of the world.
7 years ago, I got a phone call asking me to take in a baby girl. I brought her home, and I immediately knew she was my daughter, even though I hadn't given birth to her. And when I was changing her on the second or third day that I had her, I found this birthmark on her leg, the identical birthmark to my own, on the same spot on her leg as is on my leg.
I love stories like that. Your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. If you missed President Obama on primetime last night, here's the headline.
We're not hearing anything new. There was no new news out of this press conference.
That's April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks. No news is good news. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The SS Obama. 64 days out.
This is a big ocean liner. It's not a speedboat. It doesn't turn around immediately, but we're in a better place because of the decisions that we make.
The president said at a primetime news conference last night his voyage is just beginning and that history will judge whether he is moving in the right direction. Obama faces a room full of, would we call them, icebergs? On the lookout for a chilly White House press corps. Not exactly our maiden voyage. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, This is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. That was shameless. It's Wednesday, March 25th. Coming up this hour, we'll analyze President Obama's news conference last night and take a look ahead to Secretary of State Clinton's visit to Mexico. It's a very important story, and we'll figure out exactly how a nice dinner party can be pulled off for under $50. Those stories coming up. First headlines. Good economic news just out this past hour. The number of durable goods orders rose by 3.4% last month. Economists were actually expecting a 2% decrease. This is the first increase since July and the biggest one-month gain in more than a year. I know, it's easy to get excited about a positive durable goods order, but it may still take a while for the economy to recover, according to President Obama. He said last night, there's no quick fix.
It will take time. It will take patience. And it will take an understanding that when we all work together, when each of us looks beyond our own short-term interests to the wider set of obligations we have towards each other, that's when we succeed.
Look for presidential lobbying on Capitol Hill today, where the president will talk about his long-term investments in energy, education, and health care.
The budget I submitted to Congress will build our economic recovery on a stronger foundation so that we don't face another crisis like this 10 or 20 years from now.
The work starts today on Capitol Hill. Mark Garrison Wales is out there.
Good morning, John. Looking overseas, Israel's incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will seek a peace agreement with the Palestinians. He's about to start a new government launched there. President Obama's pick to be the next ambassador to Iraq has his Senate hearing today. Christopher Hill is probably best known for his role dealing with North Korea in the previous administration. Some Republican lawmakers have been critical, citing his lack of Middle East experience. Also, as John mentioned earlier, Secretary of State Clinton will be in Mexico talking drug violence strategy to combat that. The visit comes a day after Obama announced it would send more money and agents to help Mexico. Asian stocks were mixed today. Hong Kong's main index dropped by 2%, and Japan's dipped a little bit. It may be prompted by the record plunge in Japanese exports from that report today.
Wall Street was not able to keep its upward momentum yesterday. The Dow fell 1.5% to close at 7660. The S&P fell 2% to 806. But futures are sort of on fire this morning, possibly as a response to the durable goods order. I know. It's so exciting, isn't it? The futures at least suggest a flat to marginally positive opening when Wall Street opens in about a half an hour. Last night, President Obama took questions in a primetime news conference, and this morning we want to know what you would have asked the president. You can actually go to whitehouse.gov. There's a place for you to ask questions of the president. He's going to answer them on Thursday. Well, what are your questions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You might say it was all business at the White House last night. Fewer jokes than on Leno, but the president, looking grim and serious, faced a bunch of reporters who were looking also grim and attempting to take their shots, it seemed, at the president. There were some definite differences in this second primetime news conference of President Obama from anything you would have seen in the Bush administration. For instance, there were no questions on Iraq or Afghanistan, and Obama only talked about the war in this way.
One last point. In order for us to get a handle on these costs, it's also important that we are honest in what these costs are. And that's why it was so important for us to acknowledge the true costs of the Iraq war and the Afghan war. Because if those costs are somehow off the books and we're not thinking about them, then it's hard for us to make some of the tough choices that need to be made.
It's President Obama talking about the monetary costs of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it was really the only point at which those conflicts around the world came up. Joining us to talk about this primetime news event from the perspective of a television event, Adam Nagorny, The New York Times, joins us from Washington. Also, Glenn Thrush of Politico. Both of you, I understand, observed the news conference as I did on the small screen. And Adam, I'm wondering if you could give me a sense of the tone of both the president and the press corps in this relatively confrontational, it seemed to me, encounter with the press.
Yeah, I was struck by the president in particular, just sort of how calm and placid he was. He rarely smiled. His voice really rarely raised. He didn't seem to be going out of his way to sort of vigorously make any points. He just sort of methodically tried to explain things again. And I remember during the campaign, there were periods in which we used to refer to him as the professor or the lecturer. And that's the way he was today. He was not the way he was before Congress or the way he was before the last press conference at all.
Glenn Thrush, senior congressional correspondent for Politico, do you think that Barack Obama is comfortable in this more professorial role, or is he just defaulting to something that has fewer laughs than maybe Leno in 60 Minutes, which got him into a little bit of trouble over the weekend?
Well, I do think that he is was responding to some of the criticism about him being a little bit glib. But look, we're in a process moment. We're not in an inspirational moment in terms of where he is on this budget. He is going to be coming up to the Hill today to talk with Senate Democrats, who yesterday proposed a real challenge to his $3.7 trillion spending plan, really paring back a bunch of things, including his $400 per family tax credit. So part of it is, I think, the moment of his presidency, but also we're at a stage in this process where details matter, and I think he spent a lot of time last night talking about details.
Adam, do you think this concern about the deficits is going to fly nationally in the midst of this economic crisis? The president is betting it won't, but a lot of the reporters were coming again and again at the deficit in the same way that the congressional Democrats and Republicans have been doing all week.
I mean, I think you see him try to address that and say that he will reduce it in half by the end of his, I think, first term or second term. Be last that long. So he's aware of it. So, yeah, no, I think it's a potent issue. I don't think it's the main issue going out there with the general public. You don't see that in polling. It's certainly a big issue on Capitol Hill, and it's something he has to deal with.
The question of AIG came up, it seemed, once in one of the testiest exchanges. Does that say more about the AIG issue or more about the attempts by the press corps to portray themselves as not softball with this president, if maybe that was the case in the Bush two terms when the press definitely got a reputation for being softball? Glenn?
Yeah, no, I think that was, clearly that was the most interesting moment of the night. Ed Henry asked him about AIG, pressed him, and I thought Obama came back with a very with a pretty strong response, basically saying that I don't want to, it took a couple of days to respond to the AIG crisis because I like to know what I'm talking about before I speak. It was interesting gauging the reaction to that. Bill Bennett on CNN said he appeared angry. Ed Henry said that he appeared angry. I thought it was a pretty good message to send out. This is a guy who is president essentially because he projected an image of being cool and circumspect at a time of crisis. So
what did you make of Bennett? I mean, both of you. I thought that Bennett last night on CNN was out of his mind. I mean, he said he was in the gauntlet. The press corps was hitting him with everything they had. It was utterly ludicrous.
I was writing a story rather than listening to Bennett as much as
good
I
for you.
That's probably a better way to use my
good
time.
Good for you. Glenn, what did you think of Bennett?
Well, I wasn't writing a story on him.
So what did you think of Bennett?
I think there's a tendency to turn these things into into these Roman Colosseum events, and I think for reporters, it's an opportunity to really stake out who you are and how you're going to approach the president. It's a high stakes kind of environment.
I mean, that's what I was feeling. It's as though they were riding Obama's ratings. A lot of these reporters, and particularly the so-called best political team on television on CNN, which quite frankly needs to be retired at this point. But anyway, do you think that the reporters are riding this Obama popularity by being more confrontational than they might otherwise be?
I didn't notice that, but I got to be frank. I was, based on my perspective, I was paying more attention to what Obama was saying than to what any reporters were saying. And the only question that really stuck out at me, I guess, a little bit was just because of the back and forth was Ed Henry's, but also Ann Compton, who I thought asked a really thoughtful. Yeah.
Let's hear that moment. Let's hear that moment. Here's Ann Compton's moment with Obama.
Could I ask you about race?
You may.
Yours is a rather historic presidency, and I'm just wondering whether in any of the policy debates that you've had within the White House, the issue of race has come up, or whether it has in the way you feel you've been perceived by other leaders or by the American people, or has the last 64 days been a relatively colorblind time?
I think that the last 64 days has been dominated by me trying to figure out how we're going to fix the economy. And that affects black, brown, and white.
You know, he later in that answer said, you know, this notion of we've taken a step into something new racially lasted about a day in my administration. So it was a great moment and an interesting response, I thought.
Yes, it's a thoughtful, interesting moment. I mean, I think overall, you know, and again, I'm really sorry I missed Bill Bennett. But
what are you trying to get a raise at the Times, Adam? What's the deal?
No, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, to me, what's interesting about this is the country's in a really critical period. We're learning a lot about our new president. That was a very important event last night. The whole Q&A struck me as fairly routine and don't kill me beside the point. I thought it was much more interesting trying to figure out what he was doing and why he was saying. There is an argument that what he was trying to do was lower the temperature last night. And I think one of the reasons that it's interesting that AIG didn't come up till the end was not so much because of the way Ed Henry did it, but because of the fact that it didn't come up until the end. And I'll point out that Barack Obama didn't mention it in his own remarks until the end of his opening remarks because I think he wants to move on. I think he looks at that as an annoyance. I think he's angry at it, blah, blah, blah. But I think that he wants it. It's an interference with his agenda, and that's what was going on last night.
Well,
in fact, let's talk that way, I think, sort of feels the story's fading away.
Well, Adam and Glenn, let's talk about some headlines in the seconds before we go. It seems to me that the big headline was him saying no, a global currency, which is called for in remarks by China, is not appropriate at this point. He defended the dollar. That seems to me the biggest story of all. But here was his response to a question about Israel.
We don't yet know what the Israeli government is going to look like. And we don't yet know what the future shape of Palestinian leadership is going to be comprised of. What we do know is this, that the status quo is unsustainable.
Glenn Thrush, he specifically said it's not easier now with the new, what looks like a new Israeli government. Is that backing away from Benjamin Netanyahu?
I don't think it's backing away from Benjamin Netanyahu, and I agree with Adam. I think what's really interesting in the larger context is how he answers questions. I mean, this is a guy who admits ambiguity and sort of opens it up and lets you into his thought process. And I thought on the Israeli question, he isn't sure, and he sort of shared that uncertainty with the American people. It's a real marked departure from George W. Bush.
Adam, the question of maintaining a mission of the environment and health care in the budget, it seemed to me that was the theme he kept returning to again and again. Do you think he's going to be able to preserve that going forward from last night?
Yeah, I think so. The other side of that coin is that he seemed to be signaling that he could maybe live without the tax cuts being in this budget. Remember, they're in the stimulus plan, so they're around for 2 years. And also, and this is what people are looking at, that maybe cap and trade doesn't have to be in this budget. And therefore, by omission, the other two elements you just mentioned, I think, are central to what he's trying to do.
So signaling compromise, and we'll see what that plays out as on Capitol Hill today. Okay, finally, Glenn Thrush at Politico. In a tired moment, it seemed to me, Barack Obama mentioned an ocean liner metaphor for his administration. You aren't putting, like, the Titanic up on your website at this point, are you, Glenn?
Well, I don't have control of those things, but I certainly would. You know, I mean, I think he's clearly trying to give people a sense that this is something that he's making progress
slow,
on.
Slow, majestic, going
yeah.
in the right direction, ocean liner. All right, we'll take it. Adam
Maybe Mary.
New York Times, Queen Mary, Glenn Thrush, Politico senior congressional correspondent, reacting to the Obama news conference last night. Thanks, guys.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Whether the issue is stem cell research or contraception and birth control or the fight against AIDS and abstinence, we've grown accustomed to the politics and science getting mixed up. Now, without taking a position on the issue of birth control, a federal judge has ruled that the Food and Drug Administration was wrong to mix science and politics. It was wrong to delay a decision about making the so-called morning-after pill available to women under the age of 18 in an over-the-counter available context. The judge accused the FDA of bowing to political pressures of the Bush administration rather than going for hard science. Here's former FDA Commissioner Lester Crawford at a news conference back in August of 2005 explaining the delay.
The agency is unable at this time to reach a decision on the approvability of the application because of these unresolved regulatory and policy issues that relate to the application we were asked to evaluate.
FDA Commissioner Lester Crawford. Susan Wood worked as the FDA's Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health during that period. She resigned in protest to the agency's handling of the issue. She's now a research professor at the School of Public Health and Health Services at George Washington University. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Susan Wood, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Explain to me what the legal issue is here. I mean, I know that you were passionately involved in this issue, but what is the FDA supposed to do regarding science, and how do you keep an agency like the FDA insulated from politics on a hotbed subject like contraception and abortion, these sorts of things?
Oh, well, that hearing that tape took me back to when it was being blocked in 2005 and was about 3 or 4 days before I actually resigned my position. It was actually that step of blocking all women access to a safe and effective contraceptive method that really demonstrated to me that that the administration was not prepared to allow what they considered controversial to become available to women. And so the legal issue that the courts have been taking up for the last several years now is, did FDA follow its normal process? Did the experts outside and inside the FDA play their proper role in making a decision about whether a product is safe, effective, and under what conditions it should be made available, with a prescription or without? And by the time where we are today is, of course, is that the product was approved a year after that press conference for those 18 and older. And there had been numerous missteps along the way. And the court decision laid out those missteps in their ruling. The judge described, frankly, what I had seen and heard and knew about over the years that I was there, and came down with the decision that FDA did not follow the legal process of how it's supposed to go about making its decisions, that its work, its the final decision made by the leadership of FDA, not by the scientists and physicians there, was arbitrary and capricious, and that therefore it needed to first roll back the age limit to 17, but leave most of the decisions, putting most of the decision back in the hands of the physicians and scientists inside FDA to follow the normal process again and reach a conclusion that is based on the proper way FDA is supposed to do business.
You know, I can hear your frustration as a medical professional and a public health professional, but I can also hear your frustration as a woman. This delay probably resulted in conceivably hundreds of thousands of decisions on the part of young women in a way that changed their lives. How do you feel about that?
Well, what we know about emergency contraception is that it's just high-dose birth control pills. It does not cause an early abortion. It is a way to safely and effectively prevent an unintended or unwanted pregnancy for that individual if she uses it in a timely fashion. It's very important that it's taken quickly after unprotected sex, and it can help a woman who's in a situation, whether it was due to rape or a problem with contraception or whatever reason, that she's in the unfortunate situation of needing emergency contraception. And we need to, if it isn't taken within hours, it really has no effect. And so it's the timeliness of it is very important. Thus, if you need to go to a doctor, get a prescription filled, you will end up missing that window of opportunity and it frankly doesn't work. So for women, young women, even young teenagers, if they're in that circumstance, we certainly want them to have the opportunity, have the information, have the access to make a decision about whether they need to use emergency contraception at a time when it can work.
For people concerned about public health issues, what is the likely implication of this judge's decision removing politics, in theory, from good science on all kinds of public health issues? How is the Obama FDA going to be different, do you think?
Well, I think the judge's ruling is actually quite consistent with what President Obama did just a couple of weeks ago, which was sign a presidential memo directing all of the science agencies to really put science first and to ensure scientific integrity in all of its decisions, whether it's environmental decisions or health decisions or other regulatory or research work. And so this decision is not contrary at all to that. Rather, it is consistent with and actually doesn't overturn all of FDA's decision-making, but in fact says we want you, the FDA, to take a new look with new leadership who is going to stand back and let the science and the scientists and the physicians drive the decision. And that's the way it should be. And I think this is entirely consistent, and I'm very hopeful as this moves forward.
Well, looking forward to the way ahead, and thanks for clarifying that for us. Susan Wood, professor at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. She's a former assistant commissioner for women's health at the FDA. And Mark Garrison is here with some more headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, a report out just last hour shows orders for big-ticket manufactured goods, what economists call durable goods, unexpectedly rose last month. This after months of declines. Orders increased 3.4% last month, much better than the 2% fall that economists expected. The market gets to weigh in on that in a couple minutes. Futures so far point to a slightly higher open. Later in the morning, new home sale data comes out. Congress is working on the 2010 budget today. The president is on the Hill to lobby for his $3.6 trillion request. In his press conference last night, he urged Americans to be patient for economic recovery.
It took many years and many failures to lead us here, and it will take many months and many different solutions to lead us out.
Lawmakers are talking budget cuts in response to newly rising deficit projections. They may dump a tax credit favored by the president. Overseas, a Belfast court is ordering police in Northern Ireland to charge or set free several suspects in the killing of two British troops. They've been held for several weeks without charge. There are charges, however, in another recent killing. Two are charged in the death of a policeman there. Breakaway groups of the IRA have taken responsibility for both recent attacks. John.
We'll see if that sparks instability. So far, not.
So far, they've been low-key, yeah.
Mark Garrison, thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Wall Street open. The markets are bouncing upward, at least in the very, very early going. The Dow's up about 50 points. Last night, President Obama took questions in his news conference from White House reporters. Well, you couldn't be there, of course. So perhaps that's why the president actually on the whitehouse.gov website has asked for your questions. Maybe there was a question you wanted to ask that he didn't get from the White House press corps. Give us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So if you're asking me, the big story out of the news conference last night was when President Obama explicitly said he doesn't support a global currency, as China has suggested. But the second biggest story may be his response to a question about Mexico and President Felipe Calderon dealing with drug cartels there.
President Calderon has been very courageous in taking on these drug cartels. We've got to also take some steps, even as he is doing more to deal with the drug cartels sending drugs into the United States. We need to do more to make sure that illegal guns and cash aren't flowing back to these cartels. That's part of what's financing their operations. That's part of what's arming them. That's what makes them so dangerous.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is visiting Mexico today, and she's taking with her a new multi-agency security program for the U.S.-Mexico border that was announced yesterday. Mexico City BBC correspondent Stephen Gibbs has spent a lot of time embedded with forces of President Felipe Calderon as they have been fighting the drug cartels. He joined us earlier, and I asked him how important is this visit by Hillary Clinton.
I think it's extremely important because it reflects something that Mexico has been seeking from the United States for a very long time, and that is that the United States focuses on this problem, which, make no mistake about it, Mexico regards as an extremely serious problem. It's battle with drug cartels in the north of this country. For a very long time, the Mexican government has felt that the United States government has been entirely focused on places like Iraq and Afghanistan and has not been looking at this issue so close to its northern neighbor. I think it reflects really that the American administration is taking this situation extremely seriously. I think most American officials believe that they support the Calderon policy, which is really taking the cartels head on, and they want to show that they're behind the Calderon policy on that, and also that they recognize that, for goodness sake, this is not just Mexico's problem. This is very, very much the United States problem. It's U.S. consumers that are driving this market. It's American weapons that are being used in this inter-cartel fight. So Hillary Clinton coming here and then President Obama coming here next month is a reflection that this is a shared problem.
Well, Stephen Gibbs, people on this program have said repeatedly, whether they're in Brownsville, Texas, or El Paso, Texas, or San Diego, California, have said that it looks like a war zone on the border, and it feels like a war zone on the border as an embed with Mexican forces fighting the cartels. You have firsthand experience of that. Are they right?
Well, the Mexican government does not like parallels with Iraq, but I have to say that if you go to Ciudad Juarez, particularly where I was yesterday, it does seem a bit similar in a way because there are a lot of military on the street, and that is currently what the Mexicans are trying to do. It's one of their policies to try and calm down the violence there, and that is an extremely high-profile presence. And it does seem to be working. Wherever you go in the streets, you see these convoys of often police trucks, but quite often army trucks, and almost always full of soldiers with automatic weapons. And what has happened, and it's extremely noticeable, and it's been called a surge, as in Iraq, is that it seems to be working at the moment, and that is over the last couple of weeks, the number of killings, which early in January and late January were something like between 15 and 20 a day, people were being murdered. That has dropped dramatically. Now, the question is, how long can that happen? How long can they keep that up? Because they've tried this before. They did send thousands of troops early in the middle of 2007. They all stayed there, and the violence went down for a bit, and then it went up. Now, so the question is whether, now they've got almost 10,000 troops there, whether the cartels really will shy away, and there is a feeling that maybe they will, but of course maybe they then go somewhere else.
Well, it raises the question of how does Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, evaluate the success of the Calderon government? I mean, in one sense, there may be a temptation on the part of Hillary Clinton to simply seal the border and say, you folks fight it out on your own. What quid pro quo do you think is very essential for Hillary Clinton to project, even though politically it might be better for her to simply seal the border and be done with it?
Well, I think the first thing on that is that it really has been proved that that border, that enormous border that the United States shares with Mexico, is impossible to seal. It's extremely difficult to stop people crossing it, and it's pretty much impossible to stop drugs crossing it. So I think that there is a recognition that just shutting down the border completely is going to be an impossibility. And I think that that President Obama and Hillary Clinton really are prepared to take a few risks on this and make such a high-profile stance of saying, yeah, you know, this really, really is a serious problem. There are there is plenty of evidence that some of this violence is spilling over the border, with an increase of kidnappings in some of those southern states, and evidence that the cartels' brutal fight between each other, that they sometimes take over the border and fight each other in the United States. So I think she's going to have some pretty open discussions with the Mexicans, and President Obama will take that forward. And they'll see. Maybe they feel that this is a tipping point. There are some Mexican officials who do believe that their strategy is working. They believe that the killings earlier were a sign of success.
Indeed. And Stephen, we actually have news breaking out of Mexico City this morning. One of 24 top drug traffickers have been captured 2 days after the Mexican officials published their most wanted list down there. Stephen Gibbs, BBC Mexico City correspondent, embedded with troops fighting the drug cartels in Mexico. He joined us in an interview conducted earlier this morning. Mark Garrison has our headlines.
Got a few more headlines 21 minutes before the hour. The president is declaring North Dakota, where we have a lot of takeaway listeners we hear from often, a federal disaster area. That means the federal government will shoulder most of the cost to fight back expected floods in that state. Two rivers are at alarmingly high levels. Riverside towns are drafting everyone they could find into filling sandbags. In Israel today, incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he'll resume peace talks with the Palestinians once in office.
I think that the Palestinians should understand that they have in our government a partner for peace, for security, and for rapid economic development of the Palestinian economy.
Yesterday, Israel's center-left Labor Party voted to join narrowly Netanyahu's governing coalition. They're strong supporters of a peace deal, but the Netanyahu government also includes conservatives and far-right parties, so watch for strong debate within the incoming coalition. There's been plenty of anger over the AIG bonuses here in the U.S., but America has no monopoly on anger over executive pay. In Scotland, vandals have attacked the home of Fred Goodwin, the former CEO of the Royal Bank of Scotland.
Fred Goodwin?
Yeah.
Not Fred.
They don't like his $1.2 million pension, among other things.
Give us the money. Thank you, Mark.
That's what I got.
Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're going to take a moment in this segment to talk a little bit more about the news conference last night. It took an hour. The president faced the White House press corps, and there was plenty of posturing on debates going on Capitol Hill. But there was also the president openly struggling about issues that have a moral dimension, and I want to focus on one particularly. Toward the end of the news conference, President Obama was asked about stem cell research and why he rolled back the Bush administration executive order that denied federal funding for stem cell research. He was asked if he has a moral issue in his calculation that stem cell research is scientifically valid.
I have no investment in causing controversy. I'm happy to avoid it if that's where the science leads us. But what I don't want to do is predetermine this based on a very rigid ideological approach, and that's what I think is reflected in the executive order that I signed.
I meant to ask this as well, though. Do you think that scientific consensus is enough to tell us what we can and cannot do?
No. I think there's always an ethical and a moral element that has to be a part of this. And so, as I said, I don't take decisions like this lightly. They're ones that I take seriously, and I respect people who have different opinions on this issue.
The president, the professor, thinking out loud there. You can hear him struggling. It was an open, vulnerable moment, and it was interesting. It provoked thought certainly on people watching, and obviously people who have passionate feelings on this issue will take the president's answer away with them. The president also was asked toward the end of the news conference about the government in Israel and whether he believes it gets us a step closer or a step farther away from peace.
What we do know is this, that the status quo is unsustainable, that it is critical for us to advance a two-state solution where Israelis and Palestinians can live side by side in their own states with peace and security.
The president was asked if the new government of Benjamin Netanyahu actually was a step forward, and he said it's not any easier with the new government. What that means, foreign policy officials will be sorting out in the days ahead. Another huge story that came up in the news conference was about the U.S. dollar.
I would just point out that the dollar is extraordinarily strong right now. And the reason the dollar is strong right now is because investors consider the United States the strongest economy in the world and with the most stable political system in the world. So you don't have to take my word for it. I think that there is a great deal of confidence that ultimately, although we are going through a rough patch, that the prospects for the world economy are very, very strong.
That was the president's answer to a question about China's call for a global currency to replace the dollar, another big story, the implications of which will be worked out in the next several days or years. The president also called out to Americans generally to ask him questions independent of what the White House press corps might have asked, and invited people to join him at whitehouse.gov, which we also invited you to ask questions of the president. Here's a couple.
I'd ask President Obama, what is he doing to stop the corruption in the judicial process? We need to stop the corruption, the bureaucracy, and the abuse now. Our judicial system is the spine of our country. That's what I asked President Obama.
And Lucy on our website says, President Obama, can you sneak into the kitchen for a late night snack? Wonder if he'll answer. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, you got to cook a dinner for six people and you only got a picture of Ulysses S. Grant in your wallet. Dinner party that's memorable for $50 or less, right after headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, we'll add a little bit more detail on the story you mentioned of the Mexican drug lord just captured. It's Huerta Rios. He was found outside Monterrey by Mexican authorities. This, of course, in advance of the Hillary Clinton's visit there, and also after Mexico just announced high rewards, up to $2 million for information leading to the capture of a couple dozen big drug lords there. A new report just out last hour shows durable goods spiked by 3.4% last month. That's actually a shocker for economists. They expected another drop. Wall Street is open. Trading has gone up a little bit. Durable, as by the way, isn't something you buy and keep for a while. The other thing coming out this morning will be new home sales. That's out later on and coming next hour. And earlier this week, we learned sales of existing homes rose by 5% last month.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Okay, here's the problem. You got to feed six people for $50, all right? We'll take wine out of the equation, all right? But we're also taking pizza out of the equation, and we're also taking spaghetti out of the equation. You got to make a dinner party in this economic downturn for $50 for six people that's adventurous, that's fabulous, that's memorable, that's a blockbuster, and it's a competition like no other. And Kim Severson and Julia Moskin, New York Times food writers, actually took it on directly. First of all, thanks for joining us here in the studio.
Hi.
It's breakfast time. How did this competition come about, and how do you go about strategizing for such a thing, Kim?
Well, we blame our bosses, which is always a good strategy. It actually came out of a meeting, and we were talking about in these troubled times, how are people cooking? What could you do? And someone suggested, well, people aren't going out to eat as much anymore, and you still want to entertain. So someone came up with a bright idea that Julia and I would go head-to-head in a kind of culinary thunderdome and see who could come up with the best dinner party for $50. I still blame them, and I don't even know who it was exactly.
Well, Julia, the idea of feeding six people for $50 is not so outlandish, but in these days of sort of ended prosperity, certainly the catering industry and in New York particularly, the idea of whipping up a really expensive dinner party is much more mainstream. How do you be adventurous on $50 for six people and make something that's as adventurous as you might find, in a hotel in Midtown?
Well, certainly restaurant chefs and home cooks both know that protein is usually the most expensive part of the meal, of what you're buying. And so once you kind of try to either take that out of the equation, which is increasingly possible, or kind of reduce it down, you can kind of splurge on something like produce. Like I bought a dozen honey tangerines, which happened to be in season last week. That was $3. Now, if I had bought a perfectly seasoned, wonderful prime beef roast, that would have been $60. So right there, that was a way of kind of presenting something that people seem to like without spending a lot of money.
And your strategy?
My strategy was to go with abundance and handmadeness, kind of an artisan approach. I actually went to Mexico. I took a piece of pork shoulder, actually, and made carnitas. And then I thought, well, this is, you know, just going to be a big pot of boiled pork unless I do something different. And so I decided I would hand make my tortillas to add a little something kind of special to the table.
And that costs a few cents, really.
Well, that, you know, that's nothing right there. That's, you know.
Just some wheat, some shortening?
Yeah, corn. Actually, corn. Yeah. It was corn and water and a little salt. And then an entire weekend practicing so I wouldn't screw up. That was the other problem.
What are the challenges at a dinner party that are different from just, say, a meal for the family? Do you think? What do you have to project when people have been invited over and, you know, they're going to bring their own wine, okay, but...
We did two different things. Our approach to that was very different. Kim's approach was really one of abundance, and I can say this because I went to her dinner, which was a very daunting experience. She had to go first. And there were just so many things, and that, I think, was really exciting because usually for a normal home dinner, you don't expect to see seven different condiments, you know, for whatever it is that you're eating, and five different appetizers. And when she brought out the fifth appetizer, as I said, I just could not believe it.
Like a knife in my heart, I believe you wrote, yes.
This was war. I had to pull out all the stops.
She really did. It was quite impressive.
Well, let's hear the menus. Why don't you just like roll out the menus, both of you, and we'll just get a feel for what you can actually do with abundance or adventure for under $50. Julia?
Okay, well, my approach was a little bit more classic. There certainly was not as much abundance, but I tried to pick my recipes very carefully, things that were variations on stuff that was somewhat familiar but hopefully not boring. So I started with a little cold tomato soup.
Nice.
I made cheese puffs, which are, you know, traditional French gougères, traditionally made with Gruyere cheese, which can be anywhere from $8.99 to $15.99 a pound.
Now on a $50 budget dinner party, do you call them gougères or do you just say cheese puffs?
Cheese puffs.
Okay, good. Thank
in
you.
These troubled times.
Great. In these troubled times. Yeah, cheese puffs. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
So those were made with cheddar cheese from Costco, and they were, you know, really fabulous. I think American cheddar cheese is sort of an unsung hero. So I put those two together because that's like a sort of tomato soup grilled cheese sandwich thing. So people kind of like that and as a combination already. Then I went a little more crazy with a very anchovy-heavy vinaigrette for some escarole. So still pretty classic, like a green salad, but a little unexpected.
Anchovies risky for a dinner party.
Indeed.
Risky. High risk. I admire that.
If you play them right and kind of spread them out with enough olive oil and get the garlic pitch just right, people mostly will go for it. And then I had this weapon in my back pocket, which is this roast chicken, basically a roast chicken and spaghetti recipe, which, you know, what could kind of be more comfort food-like than that? I mean, really, all home cooking qualifies as comfort food.
And
don't
loves
pick sides, Hockenberry.
Everybody
don't
loves a roast
sides.
Chicken. I'm not picking sides. You go. You go, abundance lady.
No, you have to hear the rest of her menu. She's almost done.
So you just
there's more.
Take a whole roast chicken and you just tear it up into pieces and toss it with a pound of spaghetti, and that way the chicken skin and the fat, which, as we all know, is the best part, kind of makes the sauce with just a little bit of pasta water. And that is a great, crowd-pleasing recipe. I believe Kim Severson's going to be cooking it tonight for her own dinner.
A little sympathetic support for you. I didn't want you to feel badly if no one cooked your recipe, Julia.
Thank you.
Oh, this is tough. Okay, Severson, give us the abundance here, the cornucopia.
Okay, the cornucopia. First, we started out with, I had this great lower shoulder of the pork. It had the skin on it, so I was going to do a series of Mexican appetizers, little bar snacks to begin with. I took that skin and made my own chicharrones in the oven. Easy,
nice.
Lovely, crispy, delicious. Pork fat, always a winner.
And just to roast them until they're crispy.
Yeah, you put about an inch of water, you cut them into cubes, put about an inch of water over them, and you just roast them in a hot oven, stir them every once in a while. The water reduces, the fat renders out, and they're great. Then I added some spicy sweet peanuts, kind of a spicy brittle with cayenne and sugar that I made on some roasted peanuts.
Ooh, that's unfair.
It was good. Purchased a little roasted pepitas. I did some jicama with lime zest, lime juice.
Oh, man.
And then I did
the homemade
some
tortilla chips you've already talked about.
Yeah, with the tile fish. And then, so that was our little appetizer thing that we did in the living room, sitting around eating, snacking. Moved into the carnitas with my handmade tortillas.
And that's still using the same pork shoulder.
Yeah, same pork shoulder, $1.49 at the supermarket.
Man.
And then I had some charro beans, which were, I actually used Rancho Gordo, some big fancy $4 a pound beans. It was kind of my splurge. And then, of course, cabbage. I did a big slaw with the cilantro lime dressing, some pickled onions, a couple of salsas. It was pretty good at that point. And then I thought I had stuck my dessert. I came up with this recipe from Edna Lewis and Scott Peacock, gingerbread with some homemade dulce de leche that I had made by boiling condensed milk in the can for 3 hours in water.
Fantastic.
However, I have to say, I believe Frank Bruni, who reviewed us, the New York Times restaurant critic, actually liked your dessert better, and I'm still heartbroken. Why don't you tell us what your lovely dessert was.
Kim's dessert was classic. It was American. It was beautiful. It was made from pantry ingredients.
You're very magnanimous, but yours was.
Talk about a lot. Mine was a little sillier, and it was served with a straw because it was a float made from freshly squeezed tangerine juice, which is where we come back to splurging on the seasonal produce.
Oh.
A little vanilla ice cream that I made.
Stop. You've got to stop. That's great. We've got to go. I'm starving. The challenge was dinner for six in these hard economic times, but I'm full of joy. Kim Severs and Julia Mosca, New York Times food writers. Thanks for joining us. You can find all the favorite recipes from Kim and Julia's cook-off on our website, thetakeaway.org. Podcast that segment for all those suggestions. And just to feel the salivating. I mean, contact us about anything on the show at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We talked earlier this hour about U.S. efforts to prevent the drug cartels in Mexico. Alexander emailed us about, I personally don't really care about drugs coming in from Mexico. I think we need to work more on the demand in our own country. However, I hate to see millions more dollars being wasted in the fight on drugs, especially when, as it seems to me, it's not going to amount to much of a change. And here's your takeaway, the question President Obama avoided last night in his primetime news conference.
He wants to move on. I think he looks at that as an annoyance. I think he's angry at it, blah, blah, blah. It's an interference with his agenda, and that's what was going on last night.
Trying to avoid what? What? If you guessed AIG, like Adam Nagorny did, reporter for our partner, The New York Times, you are right. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,